Welcome to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and my guest today is an outstanding contributor to television and radio, defining comedy for our generation. Without him, we would not have had Not the 9 O'Clock News, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Blackadder, Spitting Image, or QI. You've worked with absolutely everyone, from Pamela Stevenson, Rowan Atkinson and Griff Rhys-Jones, to Richard Curtis, Stephen Fry, Rick Mail, Sandy Toksvig, and so many more. He's won several BAFTAs, and in 2011 was awarded a CBE for services to broadcasting. John Lloyd, welcome to Radio Aldi.
Hello, Charlotte. Thank you for that peon of praise.
Well, you deserve it. Now, can I start by telling our listeners that yesterday, when I was preparing for this chat, I became a little anxious as I wasn't sure how to condense your multiple achievements into a day, let alone half an hour. We could obviously spend all day looking back, but I think listeners will be fascinated to hear how and why you think British broadcasting has changed, which we'll get on to. But before we do, quickly tell our listeners how you got into comedy, because it's certainly a reflection of how different things were in 1973 when you left Cambridge University with what, by your own admission, was a rather poor degree in law.
I think it was the worst result that counted as a pass in the history of the Cambridge Law Faculty. It was a very, very bad third. I think it just scraped through. So I kind of, by that stage, I decided I wouldn't be a lawyer anyway. So, and I discovered over the course of 3 years, working very, very hard at all sorts of things, but not the law, that comedy writing was what I really liked doing this.
What was the first thing you did? Was that for Footlights or something?
First thing I did was I got cast in the Trinity Review, which was in those days, Footlights wasn't very prominent. They'd lost their clubroom. It'd been bulldozed to make a car park in a shopping centre called Lion Yard in Cambridge,
yeah.
So they had nowhere to go. So there was a brief period where all the hot comedy was in colleges. So I was in the Trinity Review, which the previous year had been Prince Charles, famously sitting in a dustbin doing sort of Spike Milligan impressions. So I'd actually heard of that, because it had been all over the papers. Amazingly, I'd never heard of Footlights when I went to Cambridge. I didn't go there because of that. So I got cast in this review, and then the next year, the bloke, Nick, the guy who directed it, left, and he said, do you want to take it on for the second year? So I did. And in that year, I couldn't think of a closing number for the show, so I asked the doyen of Footlights, who's a woman called Mary Allen, if she would honour us by coming to sing a closing song, and she said yes, and I fell in love with her on the spot, and then I spent the last year in a sort of wonderful romance with Mary, and she persuaded me to have a go at Footlights, which I didn't think I would be sufficiently good for, scraped into that, and it, yeah, that was fine, and it was like really, really good fun. It was very old-fashioned comedy, rather like the radio, which I ended up in, sort of lots of jokes and silly songs and things. But when it came to the big break, which is being cast in the Edinburgh Review, which is where all the big shots came to see it, all the television people, the director took me aside and said, I can't cast you, John, in this. We can only take six people for monetary reasons, so there's eight in the review.
Why not you?
Well, because I'd had a go at straight acting before that, which I'd done at school, and I'd managed to ruin two serious plays. One was The Death of Cahoolan, a one-man verse play, where I played Cahoolan, the sort of Celtic chieftain, in a leopard skin rug and a pair of my girlfriend's tights, to great merriment. That was a college review. And the really standout one was playing Crayon, the chief of police, and Anubis, the jackal-headed god in La Machine Infernale, which, as you know, is a Cocteau's searing reinterpretation of the Oedipus myth. It's a very, very dark play indeed. And all these actors were absolutely acting their socks off until Anubis, the jackal-headed god, moi, comes on wearing a papier-mâché dog's head, to a huge merriment from people. And it became quite a famous play in Cambridge. Go and see the arse in the dog's head in the Cocteau. And Stephen, the director of Footlights, Stephen Wyatt, said, you know, John, I have to make these decisions, and because, again, of financial reasons, we have to take, an Ibsen, or Chekhov along, and we can't risk you being in that, because obviously you'll turn it into some ludicrous farce. I was really hurt, and because the director could see I was about to burst into tears and embarrass everybody in the pub, he said, look, we've got this radio show. The BBC want to do a radio show. Do you want to have a go at that? And I was, first of all, very upset and rather insulted by it. And then I thought, actually, radio is the comedy I like, because it's what I grew up with. You know, I was born in 51.
What did you grow up with then? Hancock's Hour?
Actually, I never really got Hancock, but Kenneth Horne, Round the Horn, Beyond Our Ken, The Navy Lark, because my dad was the Navy, The Clitheroe Kid, all those classics. And we used to, sit over the Sunday roast with the radio on, listening to all that stuff, and it was exactly my sense of humour, and remains that way. It's still very, very funny. I like properly fall off the sofa funny. So it suited me very well. And so I was in that show. It was called, Every Packet Carries a Government Health Warning, which was the terrible title for the 1973 Footlux Review. And so I used to hang out in radio and try and write jokes for people like Bob Monkhouse and Frankie Howard and all those sort of people. And then we did a second version of called Footlights Successor, which also did extremely well in the ratings. And then they commissioned a series, which was called Oh No, It Isn't. I kind of found that I really liked being there. And I could see already that, the lure of sudden fame and success is a chimera. It may be, it may not be. After a while, this deputy head of the department, a bloke called David Hatch. So he was in the 63 Footlights Review with John Cleese, Tim Brooke Taylor, Graham Chapman, all those guys. And he was the straight man in that. And he got into radio as the producer, and risen to great height. And he came into the writer's room and said, "Do you want to be a producer?" And I said, "No." "Well, what do they do?" Because David is quite young, he's probably in his 30s, I suppose. And most of them were in their 50s and 60s, and they were very eminent people who had three names, Alistair Scott Johnson, and they'd all been used to being on the radio in the 50s, when radio was the king in the 50s, before television really had taken root. So he said, "Do you want to be a producer?" And I said, "No, not really." And he said, "I think you do. I think you could do it." And I said, "But there's no evidence. I've never directed anything in my life." He said, "Well, we think you can do it." And I said, "Okay, but I want to be a writer." He said, "That's fine. Well, I tell you what we'll do. We'll call you trainee producer and staff writer. How about that?"
Because you didn't really know the difference between a producer and a director then, did
you? No. No, not at all. I had no idea. I'd never done either of them. And in radio, there isn't really a distinction. It was a lovely system back in the day where they used to say there are only two jobs worth having in the BBC. One is the director general and the other is a producer.
Because you're in control of the content.
Yeah, you were completely trusted with everything. The content, the legals, casting, money, everything.
So you weren't going to be very good at the legals, obviously.
No, but you've got a BBC lawyer to help you and so on, and you've got your instinct. Being a lawyer, you laugh that I got a third, but I know enough law, and always have, to be able to read a contract properly and to understand the law of libel, which was particularly useful for me. I've never been sued for libel in 50 years, which I think is pretty cool. The BBC did want to settle out of court with Reggie Bosanquet. Remember him?
Yeah, I do remember him.
the newsreader who liked to tipple. Well, apparently, this is only allegedly, because this is the story I heard, that if anybody made a joke about him having a bit too much to drink, he would send a stiff legal letter. And
which proved it was true.
Well, probably. But the BBC settled for £2,000 or something, thinking, well, that's very cheap. It could have been much worse. But apparently he used to do that multiple times a year and was making really quite a serious income, sending hundreds of legal letters out, settling out of court so nobody would read about it in the papers, so he could keep doing it. He was very nice. I worked with him on a video once. He was a very nice man. It was a video very early on in Not the 9 O'Clock News called Oh Bosanquet, where Pamela Stevenson was supposedly in love with Reggie, and he came to the recording and actually got drunk and fell under the table, I seem to remember.
What was the first show you produced then?
Because I was by that time a staff writer, I worked on a show three nights a week called Late Night Extra on Radio 2. So it went out between 10 and midnight. It was live. It was fantastic fun. So it had the phone lines open. Had an amazing address where you call up anyone in the world on spec in lives. Hello, Bob Hope, it's the BBC Live. Oh, hi there, you know.
No.
Yeah, it was really great. Really by the seat of the pants. So you'd start at 10 o'clock, bottle of wine in the studio. Everybody smoked in those days. Black coffee, sandwiches, you know. And just, it was like flying some sort of mad aeroplane in doing loop the loops. Anyway, one day, the producer of that show, and I was sitting in the back waiting for my bit to come on, he said, okay, John, you're producing tonight. I said, what? He said, well, you've watched it often enough. Just sit here. You know what we do. And so, from nothing, never having produced anything, suddenly I'm sitting in the hot seat, the producer's seat in the centre, with my, you know, PA and my gram spinner and all that stuff, producing 2 hours of live radio. The adrenaline, I can't tell you, Charlotte, it was the most exciting thing. And I was kind of hooked from that moment, you know. And so I set off from that point. Then the next thing I think probably would have been Just a Minute. I was the third producer of that, starting in 1974, I think. And then Weekending, which is a late-night topical comedy show that I'd been a writer for. I started doing that. And then I started having a go at creating shows. So I did a thing with Ian Messiter, who devised Just a Minute, called Spoof, which was actually Would I Lie to You, weirdly.
Yes. Oh.
In 74, 75, but it didn't work. It wasn't properly sorted out. And then 76, that's when Nigel Rees came to me and said, I've got an idea for a quotations game called Who Said That? And I said, kind of slightly anodyne title, isn't it? What about something quote unquote with that? So, oh, he said, oh, I like that, let's do that. So we did that together, and that was, especially at the beginning, tremendous fun, because one of the things is that everybody likes radio. A lot of people don't like appearing on television, don't like seeing themselves, but I've never met a celebrity who doesn't like working on radio.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. Oh. It's also, it's still the senior medium, really, because as somebody who also worked for more than 10 years in advertising, the retention rate of radio, believe it or not, is 5 times that of television. A radio ad is much more likely to be a success than a
television. That's fascinating.
And nobody knows, because it's a secondary activity. You know, you listen to radio while you're ironing or eating or driving the car. Television, you can't really do anything else. And yet it goes literally in one eye and out the other. And so we could, especially when you're young and mad, as a young radio producer, you've got nothing to lose, have you? My favourite one of those is I'd seen this incredibly beautiful reporter watching television at home on a thing called World in Action. And she was called Anna Ford.
Oh.
And I thought, I'd so like to meet her. She is so smart and so interesting and beautiful. And so I called her up at the World in Action office and said, would you like to be on a radio quiz game? And she said, it's a kind of odd thing to ask a serious news reporter, but yeah, why not? And so she came on, quote unquote, with Terry Wogan and Spike Milligan. And given that I'd cast it in order that I would be able to meet her and take her out for a drink afterwards, in the middle of the recording, Spike Milligan announced that what they really needed was a drink, and he went out to buy a bottle of wine, got into his Mini and drove 10 minutes through the West End till he found an off-licence and came back while the audience, the full audience, was waiting for him. Came back and poured Anna Ford and Terry Wogan a glass of wine. It was wonderful fun. It lasted about 3 hours. And afterwards, they all took Anna Ford out for dinner. I never met her.
Oh, no, you're joking.
Yeah, and I didn't meet Anna again until, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. She's a fantastic person, wonderful.
So what was your first telly, not the 9 o'clock news? How did that happen?
That's it myself. It's like, again, because in those days, when you're 25, you care about these things, doing well, you know, impressing your dad and all that stuff, and maybe trying to earn a living. And I'd started the news quiz, still running nearly 50 years, whatever it is, 48 years it's been going. That was a big hit. And then the news headlines, which I started with Simon Brett. Basically, the neat thing about that was university writers, young university writers or young journalists, you know, sort of smart, well-educated people, with Roy Hudd from a sort of musical tradition, and the mixture was stellar. It was tremendously good. And that was actually, I think, certainly the longest running sketch show on radio ever, possibly even on television. It ran for 29 years. You know, I was producing 100 programmes a year. I worked very, very hard, and gosh, I was good at it. And I learned this life lesson, which might be interesting to people listening to the podcast. When David Hatch asked me whether I'd like to be a producer, and I said no, I said, eventually my second question is, what do they do? And he said, what they do is they go and make stuff they like. I said, you want me to make stuff that I like? And he said, well, yeah, because obviously then at least one person will like it, won't they? He said, if you try and guess what I like or what anyone else like or somebody you don't know or millions of people you don't know, what chance do you ever have of getting it right? And it worked for me straight away. I just did things that I thought were funny, that I thought were good. Because most people in life always are looking around, well, what do you think? What do you think? Do you like, you know, looking for another person's backup, validation?
Validation,
you know, second opinion.
Exactly, yeah.
But I didn't have that for really 2 or 3 years. And I was the hardest working producer. I was very young in the department, had tons of energy. And, you know, you could drink and go to bed and get up early and keep going. And so I started to get notice. And older comedians thought, I'd like to work with you. And they'd say, here's what I want to do. And I'd say, well, it's not really right. It's not very good. You need, this is too long and the end doesn't really work. And they go, excuse me, you can't say that to me. I'm, you know, I'm a celebrity. Barry Cryer was one who would often make jokes about it, a great oldie personality.
Yes.
And I did a series with him called Reg Aykroyd's Silly Scandals, which lasted one series. And it was a Jimmy Perry, the co-writer of Dad's Army.
Yes.
Both incredibly nice men and very gifted in their different ways, but it wasn't right for the time of radio and the things. And I came along and said, well, look, what we need to do is check. No, they said, John, this is Jimmy Perry and Barry Cryer you're talking to?
Mm.
He said, but don't you think it'd be better a little bit shorter? Or what about changing the punchline? They go, no, John, please, you know.
Leave it to us.
Yeah, we know what we're doing. And so out of respect, liking and politeness, I took a back seat and it just didn't work. It was, you know,
so interesting.
10 years too late, too old-fashioned, you know, too sort of palm courtish, really. So it didn't go. If I'm worth anything, you know, I'm going to stick to what I think is right, what I think is funny. And so I didn't do that again for 3 or 4 years. And then I moved to television. I don't know if you want to know why, but it was...
Yeah, no, why and how? How did you...
Well, I basically got lost out on 3 shows that I'd had a serious part in a single year. One was Hitchhiker, which is Douglas Adams, my best friend. He got stuck 4 episodes into the first series. He was a very slow writer and hated writing, really. He ran out of ideas, and he asked me if I'd help out, and we knocked off the last 2 in just about 3 weeks. It was easy. It was funny. We were very close friends. We'd written together a lot. It was marvellous. And then when it suddenly became very successful, Douglas had a change of heart, which you might understand, but at the time it was heartbreaking and I was very upset and very angry, but actually looked at over a long career. Of course, Douglas died, age 49, still unhappy, still trying to write things to deadlines and not making it. You know, they never managed to finish the movie, for example, while he was alive. And because he sacked me, I had to go off and do something else.
Disaster. Why did he sack you? Because he just wanted to do it on his own?
You know, I think he just kind of thought, this is all I have, I don't see why I should share it. And I've had that lots of times in my life. People think, thanks for the help, I don't need you anymore.
Oh.
No, but it's the pattern. We all have one. So 3 shows that I'd been instrumental in starting went off without me, and I was very upset then. And so the other 2 things were, quote-unquote, went to off to Yorkshire Television with Nigel Rees, with whom I co-devised it, under a different title called Cabbages and Kings. And what was the third one? And the third one was I devised what we tried to make the perfect sitcom with my friend Peter Spence, To the Manor Born. And Pete said, I think we should send it to Penelope Keith. I said, are you mad? I mean, she must be the most famous actress in Europe, let alone the UK. She was in all those Norman Conquest plays by Alan Ayckbourn, and she'd done the Parker Penn ads and then the you know, The Good Life and all that. She was a massive star. So we sent the script to her agent, and she came back straight away and said, Penny loves it. Thought, my God, we got Penelope Keith. It was like, it would be like getting Judi Dench today, you know, or Maggie Smith or something. So we were absolutely thrilled about that. And I called my booker to say, we've got Penny Keith to do this pilot. And she goes, who?
Oh, no.
I said, Penelope Keith? She said, never heard of her. So I look her up in the records. She's, well, she hasn't done any radio, John, for about 15 years. I can only offer her 60 quid a week. It just shows how we're all in silos. So we did the pilot with this chap, Bernie Braden, in the other part. And Penny said to me and Pete, I'm sorry, I can't work for 60 quid a week. No. I'm going to take it to telly, because it was a really good pilot. And it went to telly, and Pete said, do you want to come with me? And I said, well, I sort of got a job. I can't really risk it. But we tried having a go at co-writing, and it didn't work. So I resigned in a fit of pique. I could hear David Hatch. This is one of my favourite lines of all time. As I stormed out down the corridor of 16 Langham Street, which is now part of New Broadcasting House, I could hear David Hatch shouting behind me, don't be a young fool! In 7.5 years, you could be deputy head of this department! Oh, and I thought, good. That's quite an offer, you know, 7.5 years to be deputy head. Anyway, so I went to telly. So I went looking for a job I had literally no income at that point. Esther Ranson, who I'd worked with, offered me a job as one of the guys behind her, you know, the two guys with nice hair ago. And we phoned the gas board, and they said, this has got nothing to do with us. One of those people. And I basically got offered the job on a plate. And meantime, I went to see BBC Light Entertainment Television. I was very angry, and I was hoping for a job, nothing big, you know, floor manager, assistant floor manager, that kind of thing, which was a way in. And Jimmy Gilbert, the boss, said, well, what kept you? I said, sorry, you don't know who I am. He said, oh, yes, we do. Yeah, we're just waiting for you to come because we can't really hire you if you haven't got the guts to come and ask for a job. Anyway.
Oh, that's interesting.
We've earmarked 6 half-hours for you. I said, what, was a production manager? Said, no, producer. I said, sorry? Is there a pilot? He said, no need for a pilot. And then I forgot all the things that I'd learned in radio, which is don't think that now it's a proper thing you have to cast more famous people. Do what you like. And I forgot that. So what became known as the pilot of Not the 9 O'Clock News had a lot of really famous people in it that I didn't know very well.
Who did it have?
It had Willoughby Goddard, who played Gessler in William Tell, the bad guy in William Tell, big fat chap. Oh, John Gorman from The Scaffold, that was one.
Mm-hmm.
Christ knows what I was thinking, but anyway. And I honestly can't remember, Charles, it's so long ago. And
it didn't work. The famous people, the so-called famous people didn't
work. No, because there's no chemistry, you know.
No.
And I didn't know how to talk to them, you know. I didn't have a similar common culture. We were all different ages and all that kind of thing. And you've got to remember, there was no pilot. That was the first of a series of six.
Mm-hmm.
So we made this thing on whatever it was, on a Monday or a Sunday, a bit of time to edit. It was due to go out on the Wednesday or Thursday. And I'm thinking, well, this is a disaster. We don't have any ideas. We put all the ideas we had into this one thing with a cast who don't really get on and don't like each other or don't see the point of anything. So it was hopeless. And it was actually the last time, I think perhaps the second last time, I knelt by my bed one evening and said, please, God, let there be a general election, because there was a rumour in the wind that Callaghan was going to have to call a general election, which he did. And because of the rules of, under the, I think it's called the Representation of the People Act, you can't have a show like that during an election run.
Oh,
so they cancelled the series. And we then had 6 or 9 months to reset. And Second Chances, which is another great life lesson, is, you know, that was a thing that used to happen all the time, that you'd get another go.
So how did you come up with the new cast?
Well, I just went back to the principles that I'd forgotten a few years before, which is, work with people you know and like and trust your own judgment. So, and then I set out to find the people. So, I asked Griff, Rhys Jones, who had been at university with me, mm-hmm. In the same Footlights Review, and he didn't want to leave because he'd had a good job producing Top of the Form on the radio. That's something that oldies remember, you know, yeah. School's quiz.
Yeah, I mean, pretty, I remember.
Pretty lame, unless you're 15. But Griff had a solid job doing that, and so I could only get him at weekends to do the odd recording. And Chris Langham, who was somebody I'd worked with and knew as a very good writer, I know that, you know, obviously he's been through some difficulties since. Rowan Atkinson, who was in the original one, because everybody knew that Rowan was going to be super famous one way or another. So he was the one person who moved from the original pilot, as it were, to the rest of the series. And Mel Smith, who was a contemporary, he was at Oxford when I was at Cambridge, and he was in the Oxford Review when I was fired from the Cambridge Review at Edinburgh, and I'd seen him and thought, one day, that guy yeah. and I are going to work together. So I got hold of him, and we went out for a drink in a pub in Chiswick, where he was, his dad was a bookie, and I showed him the, I don't know how I could have shown him, because we didn't have VHS tape, I must have somehow shown him the a recording of the pilot, and he said, John, that's the worst half hour of television ever since. Completely terrible. So when I went back to Mel after the disastrous pilot in the pub and said, do you want to have a job now? And he said, yes. I thought, well, that's because I'm probably very persuasive. It was only after he died, you know, this is like, how long ago, 2013 he died, that I discovered that Mel had been working as an assistant director at the Royal Court and absolutely hating it. And he was just said, I'm through with theatre. It's pretentious and boring. I don't like it. I'm going to go back to my dad and say, Dad, I love racing. I want to be a bookie like you. And he was just about, it would have been like on the Friday when I said, do you want to come to the pub and have a couple of pints, that I offered him the job. On Monday, he would have gone to his dad and said, I resigned from showbiz. So I was in within 48 hours notice. You would have never known him. And so the last person was the girl. Because, you know, it's funny to think how forward-looking it was to even think that we needed to have at least one woman. And one of the big, very progressive insights of Not the 9 O'Clock News was, let's have somebody who's smart as well as attractive. Yeah, Pamela, smart, funny, and attractive. And I remember the first time we cast her as a doctor instead of as Python would have done as a nurse. And you think, this is wow, this is rad. And I think, this is absurd. My own GP is a doctor and always has been. And I perfectly well accept women as doctors in real life. But on television, in the two Ronnies, you will never see a woman playing a doctor. Just not.
No.
You will never see a woman playing a barrister or a judge. Not a chance. And television is a very conservative medium. It usually is about 15 years behind everything else, or certainly was. And that sort of thing that gives it a flavour that suddenly, that was really the idea behind Not the 9 O'Clock News, to haul comedy television screaming into the 20th century, or into the late 20th century, you know, because we really admired the two Monnies. We sort of show you knew it off by heart almost, but you know, when the two Ronnies go to the pub, they play Shove Halfpenny, you know, or Skittles.
Yeah.
You know, when they go to a party, they wear a cravat and cavalry twill trousers. Mm. None of us knew anybody who wore those things apart from our fathers, you know, maybe. And so that was a thing that was really not so much that it was satirical, it was just contemporary. It was like, this is like the city that I recognise. I live in a place like this.
And she caused a real stir, Pamela Stevenson, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. So, I mean, marvellous.
So the rest is history. So that your career took off. And tragically, as I said earlier, we don't have time to go through it step by step. But what would you say, what's the highlight?
I would have to say, Charlotte, it's a sketch on Not the 9 O'Clock News called One Day in a Swedish Chemist's Shop. where Rowan is playing the Swedish chemist and Mel comes in and he says, good morning, I would like some deodorant, please.
And that's so funny already.
Rowan Atkins says, Certainly, sir. Ball or aerosol? And Mel Smith says, neither. I want it for my armpits. Anyway, it's a very good, very, very funny joke. It's a bit like on QI when people say, what's the most interesting fact you know? I mean, we've processed, you can see we're here in the QI library.
Oh my God,
we have processed
listeners.
Hundreds of thousands, millions of facts probably over the last 25 years. It's impossible. All I can remember is the ones that I thought of, you know, I came across first 25 years ago. I generally say, to avoid the question and not to be ad hominem, that the thing that I'm most proud of is I'm still married to the same person I promised to stay married to, and I both like, I love and also like all my children. And I think that's quite an achievement.
Quite right. I think that's brilliant. So what are you doing now?
All I want to do, really, is do what I started out doing, which is write and perform. That's what I like doing. That's what I think I can do.
Do you still like performing as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I do, absolutely. You know, I've done shows at the Oldie, you know, I did actually the last one with Barry Cryer before he died, which is marvellous. And I've done three shows at the Edinburgh Festival, one-man shows. I'm trying to write these four science fiction books, which are the books I was trying to write when Douglas came along and said, have you got any ideas? And I gave him the MS of my original novel. You know, so I have this strange sort of curvature. It's like, all I wanted to do with QI was research the universe for the rest of my life, find out about bees and mollusks and, you know, the ethnic groupages of Ghana, and that's what I like doing. It's what makes me perfectly happy. But, you know, in a small way, we're too successful for that, you know. So you've got, you know, 25, 30 people to look after, and there are careers, and there's HR, and there are legals, and there are commissioning meetings, and, you know, development discussions. And, you know, I spend the whole week processing stuff. It's one of the reasons I don't write for the Oldie anymore. I haven't got a day and a half free to sort of free fall and do something that I really enjoy. And if you looked at my, I haven't brought it with me, my list of things to do is just over one A4 side of, you know, very closely typed. These are all the things that I must do immediately.
Yep.
And most of them I don't want to do.
But it's also distracting you from your four books. Why four science fiction books? Isn't one enough?
That's what my wife says. And she was a publisher, and she should know.
Are they linked?
Yes.
Right.
But I don't know. It's just that feels like the structure. It's the one that I've lived with for close on 30 years. It's four books that tell a story in which each book has a main protagonist. And they all appear as minor characters in all the other three books.
Great. So you're doing that?
Yeah.
Radio, Museum of Curiosities, finished?
They've axed that, rather. I don't think there's a very good reason for doing that, but there you are. That's somebody's decision. And I've got another really interesting project, which is kind of devise a completely new kind of museum, which has been something that's been in the QI business plan, insofar as we have a business plan in the bag of ideas that we have. I've always thought there should be a museum where everything is interesting and where the captions are as interesting as the exhibits, which is one of the things that really annoys me about museums, is you've got this amazing, whatever it is, a Cézanne or, you know, a skull of a, you know, dinosaur or something, and it just says, you know, painted in 1905, you know, and exhibited, you know. What is that? It again, people sometimes say you must be very proud of QI because, you know, it's been running for 23 years and it's an amazing success. It's nothing like as successful as I thought it was going to be, because when you think about it, you know, 23 years is less than half as long as the news quiz has been running,
yeah,
which is also
yeah.
something that
yeah.
I devised.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem strange to me that, you know, people say it's terribly clever to do it about a different letter of the alphabet. I said, no, it's like it wasn't clever to set Blackadder in history. That wasn't the reason we did it, so that it wouldn't date. We did it because we thought it was funny.
So just before I let you go, I know you and I both talked about this before quite a lot. Just what's changed in broadcasting since you started?
Ian McGilchrist wrote a brilliant book about 10 years ago called The Master and His Emissary, about the two halves of the brain and what they do and why we need both halves to work. The right-hand side is the world of ideas and imagination and dreams, and the left-hand side is the hello, chartered accountancy is not boring. It's efficient and effective, but it doesn't have any colour or any fun. And so a society, in McGilchrist's contention, needs both things. You can't just have measurement and facts and so on. And what's gone horribly wrong with the world is that this thing has arisen that if it can't be measured, it's not true. Well, it's not valuable. And the double meaning of value is, you and I know perfectly well, and so do the oldies, what matters is not necessarily financial. The value of something, you can say, the value of my garden to my well-being is beyond price.
Yeah.
It's not all about money.
No.
But the society is telling us, yes, it is all about money. Yes. The people who have the money tell you what to do because they're better than you, because if I'm worth $300 billion, I'm better than all of you. I'm a master of my universe and you're just a peon. So what's happened in science and with that, everything else in society and so on, is if it can't be measured, it's not valuable, it's not worth having. And then what happens is research groups come in, and research groups, what do you like? And they, of course, are terrified of getting it wrong.
Market research. Yeah. It's going back to what you were saying earlier. If you make it for what you think people are going to like, it won't be funny.
Well, that's right. I mean, do you think Beethoven did market research? No, Ludwig, you know, he's so simple, you know. Or Van Gogh, you know, it's what's happening with AI. It's come home to roost, Charlotte, because AI is perfectly, what I'm saying is that its AI overview is the sort of schlock, the sort of generalised schlock that everybody else think, the most general sort of thing, this is what people generally like and generally will put up with. And that isn't what makes life worth living is something that stuns you, isn't it? It's like, oh, that's amazing. I've never seen anything like that. Market research says, I've seen something like this. Here's something that's a tiny bit different to what you've just seen that doesn't frighten you, but it's more of the same, which you're prepared to pay for. And that's sort of crept into everything that, you know, rather than the way it used to work at the Beeb, is that people would, your boss would look you in the eye and you say, I can't believe you said that idea. It seems completely mad. Are you sure that's what you want to do? And you go, I'm really sure. It's the stuff that most people think is never going to work in a million years is the stuff that goes on to be huge and lasts forever. I can't tell you the number of people who said to me when we were trying to sell Spitting Image, you know, Lloydie, you know, puppets is for kids, you know, that's like Punch and Judy and little dollies and things. It's not for grown-ups.
So what keeps you going then? What's keeping you optimistic?
The thing is, it's lovely to have QI because I always have that as a default position, is that I'm never going to be bored. So we're coming up to the QI X series. I haven't been formally commissioned yet, but obviously a series of 14 shows all about things beginning with X. This is the thing, and it's something, again, I hold dear. If it's not difficult, it's probably not very good. That's something I've learned over the years, is that in Buddhism, for example, they have this great line, the obstacles are the path. If you think that you feel blocked, it's probably because you're on the right track. I think it's another thing I have learned is there's a great deal to be said for patience and waiting. It's like the universe will unfold when it chooses to, not when you wish it to. And so I'm sort of waiting for that to happen. So that's a thing. You think achieving patience, well, what's patience? That's a big deal, no. Patience is very, very important.
Well, that's a good place to end. John Lloyd, thank you so much for being on Radio Oldie.
Thank you, Charlotte. It's been lovely seeing you.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with John Lloyd. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more conversations like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, my very, very warm thanks again to you, John Lloyd, to you, Bailey Gifford, for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.